Turn up the laughs this summer with SBS. The Parasocial Social Club sees comedians Jenny Tian and Kevin Jean swapping sharp, funny takes on life, friendships, and all the awkward moments in between. Comedy Karma brings you Australia's best comics as host Aditya Gautam uncovers the story behind their favorite jokes. Listen now on the SBS audio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's been just over a month since the government enacted its world-first social media ban for those aged under 16 years old. The government says they have deactivated, removed or restricted 4.7 million accounts so far. But what does this figure mean? And is an outright ban the most effective method for mitigating young people's exposure to harmful content online? In this episode of Weekend One-on-One, Katrina Stirrett speaks to Nicholas Cara, the director of the Centre for Digital Cultures and Societies at the University of Queensland.
I guess starting off a bit broadly, I know it's early days. We're just over a month into this, you know, world first social media ban. But how successfully do you think the ban has been implemented so far?
Oh, like, I think what we're discovering is something that we predicted, is that it'd be a sort of uneven story and it'd depend on what you thought success looked like. And so it's been interesting, I guess, over the last week to firstly see the platforms on the front foot and now to see the government, you know, kind of confirming the story, you know, about, you know, that, well, the reporting today that over 4 million accounts were banned in that first week. And I think that's, you know, the platforms want to show that they've done what they're meant to do, and the government wants to show that broadly it's working as intended. And I think that, you know, I think here we have to say there's something interesting has happened, that a government has said to platforms for the first time in the world, you have to ban under 16s, you have to use these measures to do it. And the platforms didn't threaten to leave the market. They didn't take the government to court. They actually went ahead and did what the government wanted them to do. So that's interesting, I think. That's an interesting milestone, an important milestone. But, you know, I think there's this other story that's much harder to get a handle on, and we don't have a handle on yet, which is, you know, to what extent, you know, what we're hearing from early kind of work with young people is that many of them are still on social media in one way or another. And I think the benefits and harms of banning young people from social media, as we always anticipated, would be really unevenly shared. It'd be good for some young people and harmful for many others. Yeah, and I think it's interesting to kind of delve into that story of what young people have been doing this summer, you know, since platforms shut down their accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. So much to unpack. But I guess just starting off looking at that figure that, as you mentioned, the government held a presser, which I was watching just before, announcing that 4.7 million accounts have been deactivated, removed or restricted so far, noting there's approximately 2.5 million Australian children between 8 and 15 in Australia. And I think it was something like 85% of 8 to 12 year olds were on social media.
Yeah.
I guess could you just sort of extrapolate for me a little bit how indicative this figure is of a success here, or does it perhaps not paint the full picture?
I think it's, you know, if you read that headline, you think, oh, wow, all their accounts are gone. That's, you know, that's great. But I think that there are many other things that are probably going on. So as you kind of said, you know, 4.7 million accounts have been banned. You had the number on how many under 16s there were on social media, but it's 2 million and something. And, you know, like, so firstly, you got to say, okay, like, many teenagers are going to have 3 to 4 social media accounts. They're going to have Snapchat, Instagram, YouTube, definitely, maybe going to have Facebook account, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. TikTok. Yeah. So, you know, so many of them are going to have many more than 2 or 3. If they've banned 4.7 million accounts and you've got, you know, 2.5 million under 16s in the country who were on social media, but they all have 3 to 4 accounts each, then you kind of need to ban 10 to 15 million accounts to have said you've got them all, I think. And then I think the other thing that's kind of, we just don't know enough about what else might be going on. And there are three sort of things that I have in mind. And that's, you know, if you're on your account and you're under 16, you've been using it for a while, the platform can probably pretty confidently judge you're under 16 and it's going to shut your account down. But then the question is, how easy is it for you to create a new account from scratch? And now how might you do that? And that gets us to the other things. Well, we know a lot of people, their parents have set up the account for them and handed it over to their young person, which is legal. Like, families can decide to do that under the legislation. You know, many young people will have, you know, sort of experimented with setting up a new account and tried different things, used a face filter to make themselves look older, or scrunched up their face, or asked an older friend or a sibling or who knows what to pass the age verification test. And then I think a lot of young people are probably using particularly the more entertainment-oriented platforms like TikTok and YouTube. They're probably, you know, using them in a logged-out state. They're sort of still consuming algorithmically curated content in that sort of a way.
Yeah, so there's definitely, yeah, as you mentioned, there's plenty of workarounds happening already. I spoke to a bunch of teenagers on Tuesday, and it sounds like, you know, they've been banned off some and not others. And there was mixed responses about the positives and negatives for that. I suppose the intention from the government with the ban was to limit children's or teenagers' exposure to harmful content and things like cyberbullying. I know it's early days, but do you think the ban will work in that way as the government intended?
Not on its own. So I think the ban is, I think what we're discovering about the ban is that it's a blunt and kind of regressive step, because firstly, the bluntness of it means that, you know, I think practically we're going to have to admit sooner or later that heaps and heaps of young people, particularly young people who are motivated to get on social media, it's not that hard to get around the ban. And then, you know, we're going to have to admit that many young people will be using sort of social entertainment platforms in a logged out state and accessing highly algorithmic feeds that are actually less moderated and less regulated than ones that they were using in a logged in state. So we're going to encounter all of these issues, and then I think what will come into view is that the need for the government to take the step that it's already flagged that it intends to take, which is to legislate a duty of care, because we need to get to a point where you're not just saying to platforms, ban young people and then do whatever you want. We sort of saying to platforms, you actually have a duty of care to your users, and this is what it looks like. You know, I really hope that we would get back to a point where you could have, you know, a strong duty of care that meant there wasn't a need in the view of the government and others for a ban, you know.
Yeah, and I want to touch on that digital duty of care in a moment, but I suppose just back as well, even logistically, to how the platforms are, I suppose, getting away with only half committing to this ban, it seems, just from anecdotally hearing from kids, some are banned off certain platforms and not others. It seems to work in some kind of randomised approach at the moment. How is this happening? I know the eCivita Commissioner said that the next steps are recidivism and ensuring there's no reactivations of new accounts and so on, but how is it operating at the moment, and how are some kids still able to access certain platforms?
So I guess what the, you know, it's sort of a feature of the way the legislation's been implemented, in that platforms were required to offer, a range of approaches to age assurance, and they had to offer an alternative to an ID card, you know. So one way you can do it on some platforms is to scan your driver's license or a kind of valid ID. And of course, many Australians would feel very uncomfortable about that, I imagine. So they have to offer an alternative. And it's the alternatives that just always are going to offer this sort of scope for you know, the alternatives are always going to be reasonably easy for young people to get around, because they use something like age estimation technology using a photograph. And, you know, in the digital age, it's so easy to manipulate photographs or get someone else to stand in front of the camera or whatever it might be. So so then you get to this point where, well, the eSafety Commission, you know, the way the legislation is written, it can hold platforms to account where they're not taking, you know, reasonable steps to stop this kind of systematic getting around the ban. But you kind of then hit with this kind of collision between what are reasonable steps look like when you're also saying to platforms, you must offer an alternative to the sort of the verified ID. I think there's, you know, the platforms might be like, well, these are the best and the most reasonable technologies that exist to do what you're saying we need to do. So what else can we possibly be expected to do? And I think that's where I think the next year or two are actually going to be really interesting, to see how the Safety Commission finds, if you like, the balance or the line with the platforms, how much the platforms are going to exercise their enormous power to influence the eSafety Commission's interpretation, I suppose, of what looks reasonable and what's technically possible. So I think this is where, you know, it gets interesting. The platforms have complied and done what they're meant to have done in the first month or two. But then how do the platforms and the eSafety Commission deal with the fact that, you know, the ban is pretty easy to get around?
Yeah, it sounds very complex. And as you said, over the next couple of years, we'll probably have a better idea of how things play out. And you did mention something that I wanted to ask you about as well, which is that digital duty of care, which the eSafety Commissioner has described as sort of a next step forward for the government, requiring platforms to, you know, take responsibility to make online spaces safer and for everyone, essentially. Do you think this is a good idea, a good kind of next step for the government to be taking?
It's an imperative step. And I think that, you know, there was lots of debate about the ban and there was lots of support for the ban, but that from a lot of experts, there was a lot of criticism of the ban, both its effectiveness, the harms it might do and so on. But I really hope with the duty of care that everyone can agree this is imperative. And I think, you know, one of the ways I think about a duty of care is we shouldn't see it as such a radical idea. Like, we did this in the 20th century for broadcast media. We didn't call it a duty of care, but we typically had a broadcast act that set rules about what you could and couldn't do, you know, because it would be harmful to broadcast certain kinds of content. And so it's just like that, but for the digital age. We're calling it a duty of care this time around, but we're basically saying you are enormous publishers of enormous amounts of content. You need to take responsibility for it. You need to exercise some editorial control. And we're going to say what that responsibility is. So I think that's just really important, and we should see that as something we did in the 20th century, and here we are, we need to do it again.
Now the OTR app makes happy washing your car even easier. Select and pay with the OTR app. Simply scan, wash, and go. It's happy wash, happy car at OTR.
Celebrate culture and connection this summer with SBS. Say Kimchi brings you a taste of Korean culture through a distinctly Aussie lens. SBS Spice serves up fresh takes on South Asian Australian life, unpacking pop culture, identity, food, sports, and more. And Chinese-ish dives into what it means to be a young Chinese Australian. Listen now on the SBS audio app or wherever you listen to your podcast.
Yeah, and just finally, I know you mentioned earlier the kind of outright ban approach isn't the most sensible, I guess, method in terms of trying to make these spaces safer, particularly for children. What would you kind of suggest, or what kind of methods do you think could be established to sort of improve these spaces for children without perhaps doing this black and white sort of approach?
Yeah, it's tricky. Like, I think that the problem with the ban is that for a lot of people that were already on social media, you know, that these are really important social places. This is often this was the infrastructure of many under 16s social lives. It was how they knew and connected with their friends, found other people like them. And this was more important for some young people than others. And so, you know, you're hearing the stories we expected to hear of, you know, young people in regional areas for whom social media is just a really important way of staying connected with peers, particularly if there's no one kind of like you in your regional area. If you're someone who's from a diverse background or is having, you know, a diverse sexuality, gender experience and so on, like, social media was really important for connecting with peers who might be like you, who are not kind of proximate to you in your actual everyday life. And so that this kind of stuff really, really matters. And I think this is where we're going to see the harm kind of concentrated. I think one of the things I tend to think about, is the teenagers that were sort of on social media when the ban came into effect are probably most harmed. What might happen over the coming years if the ban stays in effect for a long time? You know, will we develop ways for young people to develop social digital networks, ways of socializing that are not on these platforms? And I think we're going to have to say, if we banned young people from these important spaces, we need to help them create other kinds of spaces where they can live their social lives. and not just sort of leave them blowing in the wind. Like, what are they meant to do? So this kind of the duty, I guess, a long-winded way of saying the duty of care is not just us saying to the platforms, here are your responsibilities, but it's sort of like us thinking about, as a society, our duty of care to young people in a digital age, that isn't framed just by, like, we must keep young people away from the harms on social media. Like, a really important part of our duty of care is actually a positive one, which is to say, what are we going to do to enable young people to connect, socialize, be creative with each other in the digital world? Because that is the world, and that is their world now. You can't kind of exclude them from it until they're 16, and think, you know, we did the best thing for them. I just don't think we would have, because we would have, you know, done harmful things to their social world before they turn 16, and then they won't be very well prepared for what happens when it all switches on at 16. So that's sort of the big picture. And the more focused picture, I think, is the thing we often kind of zoom in on a bit too quickly, which is to say, okay, well, a duty of care basically means saying to major platforms, here are the rules that you must follow, and here are how we will enforce and monitor the rules, and here's what the penalties will be. And I think what we've done over the last decade or so is basically leave platforms to set their own rules and set their own, make their own judgments. And, you know, so you see platforms like Meta establish, say, advisory boards around harmful content, for example, content relating to eating disorders, and then, you know, put experts they like on those boards, take those experts' advice to set up certain moderation policies and implement them in the way that they see fit, and so on. And I think a duty of care would be to say, actually, the public, the government has a material interest in this and how you do it. And what kinds of harms are happening, what kinds of rules need to be set, and how we'll monitor and enforce those. So I think that's sort of, you know, in a focused way, what a duty of care really needs to look at. And then you should be able to say, you know, if we're successful, we should be able to say these places are safe for, say, 12 to 16 year olds, because we know we've set rules that make them safe. And I think the final thing I'd say is, like, you know, we do that in so many other domains of young people's lives. You know, if you think about all the rules around playgrounds and play centres and schools and everywhere else young people tend to go, it shouldn't be so, outrageous to say we can set rules for this really important space that young people hang out in as well.
Yeah, it's definitely early days at the moment, but it'll be so interesting to see how this law is kind of refined and also received in coming years as well. Thanks so much, Nick. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, great to chat.
Yeah, give me that happy wash.
Scratch-free guarantee.
Make me feel like a limousine.
Happy wash, happy car at OTR.